Body clocks, sleep and light. I thought we'd cover the following topics this evening. But first of all, an introduction to this internal time, these body clocks, these circadian rhythms. Then talk about the neuroscience of clocks and sleep. And then how they're regulated by the eye and how important light is in this whole process. And then working against the internal time with some very specific advances of what goes wrong when we don't get our body clocks and our sleep right. And then some recent work on the relationship between sleep and circadian rhythm disruption in mental illness. And it's a new field which is turning out to be, I think, extraordinarily exciting. So let's kick off. Oh, yeah, oh, yes. Well, I can't but help draw your attention to this extraordinary book here. And much of what I'm going to say is actually summarised in this very short introduction. It's part of the OUP Press series. And clearly this is shameless advertising, and I sort of apologise, but you have to understand, and I know there's many authors in the audience, but you go into a bookshop and you see a great pile of your books, and you all sort of swell up with pride, and then you see that they've all been discounted to 50p. so go buy. All right, but seriously, a lot of what I'm going to discuss is summarised in there. So let's kick off with this introduction to internal time. And the point that 24-hour body clocks, as I said, circadian clocks, and sleep processes have really sort of captured the popular imagination. You can't open many magazines these days without seeing something about these body clocks. But I would point out that sometimes this high publicity is not always particularly helpful. And I thought I'd just share a story with you, in fact, share some pain with you, about an encounter I had with the Daily Mirror. And I worked quite hard on this particular article with Beth Gibbon, and I was very comfortable with natural rhythms rule our bodies and dictate the best times for a range of activities, and here's our countdown. I have to say, though, beyond that statement, I was far less comfortable with the whole article. So, for example, 10 a.m, have a bikini wax. Or an injection, or a visit to the dentist, basically anything with an ouch factor. Pain intensity is at its lowest between 8 and 10 a.m., says Professor Russell Foster. It's not entirely clear why, but it's probably because pain receptors aren't as alert as they are later in the day. And I promise you I didn't say that. And I certainly didn't say 6:30 p.m. heralds the start of 2.5 hours of sex and booze. So if you're feeling a little frisky at the moment, then you know exactly why. Okay, well, of course, all this nonsense alludes to some truly remarkable biology. And here we see a cartoon of an individual with lots of different changes of physiology and behaviour at two times of the day. And in a sense, any particular biological parameter you would like to measure will show a 24-hour oscillation. And we see here just a few of them. And we'll look at some graphs of these in a moment. Core body temperature, high during the day, low at night. Growth hormone, urine production, cerebral blood flow. All of these things are constantly being adjusted. They have their own internal rhythm of going up and down over the 24-hour period. Now that rhythm, and as I say, we'll see lots of patterns in a moment, is locked on to environmental time as a result of exposure to the light-dark cycle. And that's something we're going to talk about in some detail later on, the biology of this light-setting process. But I just want to give you some examples of where a mismatch between these beautifully aligned rhythms and the light-dark cycle occur. So, for example, in jet lag and shift work. Now, they're very different, but they are related to this mismatch between biology and the external light-dark cycle. So, if we think about shift work, you can be on the night shift for 20 years, and your body clock will not adapt to the demands of working at night. So if you think what the night shift worker has to do, they have to work during the night when their physiology is essentially in the resting state. So what the night shift worker has to do is cognitively override the body saying, now is a good time to be asleep, and attempt to function. And as we'll see later on, there are lots of health consequences associated with that, but what you can't possibly expect is peak performance on the night shift, and that's something we may want to discuss when you've seen some of the other data that I'll present later. Shift work is very different from another sort of biological phenomenon that we impose upon ourselves, which of course is jet lag. Just recently I flew from London to Los Angeles, And I was just about to say something really rude about Los Angeles, but I realise I'm being recorded, so I won't. And the problem about jet lag is that one's, for example, here's one's core body temperature, is misaligned to the new light-dark cycle. But it's not that simple. It's not that body temperature and the rest of biology is misaligned with the new time zone. It's the fact that everything is inappropriately aligned to each other. And that's why jet lag feels so ghastly. It's a smear of temporal organisation. And it's only when you've got a strong signal of the new light-dark cycle that this becomes aligned and everything becomes then realigned to each other. That's how you get over jet lag, primarily. Okay, so there's some early examples of where rhythmic biology and the light-dark cycle need to be matched up. But let's look at some of the physiology and health implications of this internal representation of a day. So the first one I want to draw your attention to is core body temperature. Core body temperature reaches its low point at around about 4 o'clock in the morning. But then in anticipation of activity, core body temperature starts to rise. It peaks at around about 8 o'clock in the evening. So by the time this lecture is finished, your core body temperature will have been the highest it has been all day. Then in anticipation of sleep, it will start to drop to its low point. Now, most of the time we're unaware of this, unless we happen to wake up in the middle of the night and you'll feel cold. And that's because your core body temperature is about a degree lower. But if you're an athlete, this has a really important set of implications. Any athletes in the audience? Any swimmers or runners? Or I have to say, you don't look particularly athletic. But, sorry, that was a little rude. I didn't mean it to come out quite like that. but the point is that if you're an Olympic swimmer, for example, and you're swimming 100 metres, you can swim that 100 metres almost 3 seconds faster at 8 o'clock in the evening than you can at 6 o'clock in the morning in the training sessions. And that's because, of course, that even degree change in core body temperature changes muscular efficiency, changes how well the muscles can work. And of course, if you exercise, you're going to change. You'll increase core body temperature. But the point is, it's upon this moving endogenous baseline. And so you'll notice, you may remember from the recent Olympics, that all the big events, all the major finals, the track events and the swimming events, were late afternoon, early evening. And they pushed them to that time, not because they understand the biology, but they just know that's when records are more likely to be broken. If we think about growth hormone. Now, growth hormone is largely secreted at night. So if you have a child with a potential growth hormone problem, then you can't take a blood sample during the day and assess what basic levels of growth hormone are. You have to take the child in overnight and you have to get the complete profile. And that's true not just for growth hormone, but for many hormones. Many of them are released at night. Urine volume. Urine production is low at night, as we probably all appreciate, and then rises in anticipation of dawn and peaks at around about noon. Now, we talked about our night shift worker earlier. They don't adapt. So one of the huge problems that the night shift worker is facing is that they're trying to sleep when their urine production is at its highest point. And as we all know, the bladder is an extremely effective alarm clock. And that's one of the reasons why night shift workers have such appalling sleep. If we think about cerebral, the blood flow to the brain, and we don't really quite understand this, but it peaks at night, which correlates with the fact that if you're likely to have a burst blood vessel in the brain, and a stroke as a result of a hemorrhage, then it'll be at that time of day. Interestingly enough, we really don't understand why blood flow to the brain is at a peak. Perhaps it's something to do with sleep processes, but we're just guessing. Another one, of course, is blood pressure, peripheral blood pressure. This is in the brain, this is in the periphery. Again, blood pressure rises in anticipation of activity before we get up. And this rise in blood pressure during the just before we wake up in the early morning, has major consequences on our health. And these are some studies by Peter Rothwell in the Oxford Vascular Study. And what he has plotted here, is time of day against the chances of having a stroke. Now that's a clot that's formed in the blood vessels of the body. It's become detached and it's lodged into the brain and then damages the brain. What you'll see is that between 6 a.m. and 12 noon, there's a 49% greater chance of having a stroke than any other time of day. So we can start to think about using this information, that if we want to add, for example, anticoagulants to dissolve those clots, then they should be given here and not here, because it's almost too late. So very important implications about time of day. If we think about alertness, this is a very marked rhythm in our levels of alertness. And I think intuitively we would know that at 4 o'clock in the morning we wouldn't be at our best. But some very nice studies have compared the effects of the cognitive impairment when you consume alcohol and the cognitive impairment you have at a particular time of day. And what's remarkable is that at 4 o'clock in the morning, your ability to process information is worse than if you consumed sufficient alcohol to make you legally drunk. We're worse, we're effectively worse cognitively than if we were drunk. So if you happen to be driving a car at that time of the day, then your ability to drive that car is as bad as if you got in with a few whiskies and a few pints of beer inside you. Really serious. And that, of course, can help explain why the accident rate is so much higher on the night shift compared to the day shift. If we think of melatonin, I've added this because I suspect there may be questions later on. Melatonin is called the Dracula hormone by some because it only comes out at night. And it's also been called a sleep hormone, which is wrong. But it may be involved in sleep processes, and that's something we can perhaps discuss later on. And then all these metabolic hormones like cortisol and thyrotrophin, which gives rise to the release of thyroxine from the thyroid gland. And all of these are anticipating increased activity. The point about going on and on about this is that what's happening is that this body clock is fine-tuning every aspect of our physiology and behaviour to the varying demands of activity and rest. It's an extraordinary machine. And all of these rhythms will continue even if we went to a dim, dark cave, constant light, constant temperature. They would all occur, but they drift through time. There wouldn't be this light-dark cycle to align it. Clearly, when you have this dynamic physiology, this will have implications for drug treatments. Drug treatment should intersect with a pathology when it's at its peak. We talked about, for example, stroke and anticoagulants. But there are lots of ways in which we can use this dynamic change in physiology to fine-tune our delivery of drugs. However, most drugs and treatments are not given on the basis of body time, but on the basis of convenience alone. You ask your GP, when should I take my drug? They'll say at lunchtime, or when you eat. Now, most of the time it's because the drug won't have an irritant effect upon the stomach, but you're told to eat it, told to take the drug when you eat, because you'll remember. Most of the problem with drug taking is non-compliance. People forget. But if they know that when they eat, that's when they should take their drugs. Pharmaceutical companies are perfectly well aware that the timing disease peaks at certain times of the day. But they develop drugs that survive for a long period of time in the body, and so more or less peak with these peaks of disease. They say, well, what's the point? I mean, it's very difficult to sort of give people drugs at particular times of the day. So what we'll do is we'll give a drug at a high concentration and it'll last a long time. So it'll more or less coincide with the pathology. But this strategy is really daft because it greatly increases the potential side effects that medications will have. So, for example, you have side effects, and if you're on one drug, you're almost certain to have another drug. More drugs, more side effects, more drugs. And this is actually a very, very serious issue, which is to a large extent ignored within drug development and in the application of new treatments and new therapies to specific diseases. What I'm arguing here is for intelligent and informed delivery of medicines. And this not only relates to when you get to the patient end, but also right at the beginning when you start to test these drugs. If you think about it, drug testing is using mice and rats. Mice and rats, of course, are nocturnal animals. So just think about this for a moment. This is a human sleep-wake pattern. We're awake during the day. This is when we normally take our drugs, our medications. But, of course, they're tested on night-active animals, a mouse or a rat. So what's happening is that you're waking up a mouse in the middle of its sleep phase, looking at the impact that drug will have on the physiology of that animal, and then extrapolating it 12 hours to the wake phase of us. Does 12 hours actually matter? You bet. These are some actual data which I thought I'd show you, looking at the effects of toxicity on this, this case it was mice, and this is just one example. Here's 100% death to 0% death, and you see that at the late sleep phase, there's 90% mortality, whereas in the middle of the active phase, it's lower than 40%. Huge difference. Same dose, same concentration, delivered in the same way, except the variable is time of day. And you can look at a whole range. This happens to be a bacterial toxin. Again, we have 90% mortality in this case to lower than 20% mortality. Hugely dynamic effects. And as I say, currently drug testing is performed on nocturnal rodents and extrapolated to ourselves. Now, I don't think dangerous drugs have got to market because of this inappropriate testing. But what has happened, of course, is that you've worked on a drug. And you think, this is going to be great. The first way you test it is look at any toxicity effects upon an animal model. And it's quite right. I think I can completely accept the need to do that. But many drugs are dismissed early on because they have high levels of toxicity. And my terror is that sitting on the shelves of Switzerland, in Basel, and in London, there are drugs that could be incredibly powerful, but they've been tested at the wrong time, they give us the wrong impression of their efficacy, and they've been then essentially dropped. And I think there's an argument for retesting very many of those drugs. Does time of day actually have an effect upon us in terms of treatments? Well, I suggested that it had, but I didn't give you any evidence for that. And this is an early study, and I'm just illustrating this. This is 1993. We've known this for a very long time. Chemotherapy in children with leukemia, given in the morning versus the evening. And this is the same treatment, but those given the drug in the morning versus the early evening had a 2.5-fold greater chance of relapse than those in the evening. Same drug, same concentration, different time of day, hugely different impact upon long-term survival. And this has been shown not only for childhood leukemia, but ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and breast cancer. So this is a very active area, but it's not really made a huge impact in terms of clinical practice yet. Okay, let's now think about the nuts and bolts of clocks and sleep. So how are these 24-hour days within actually generated? And of course, for this is the most complicated object in the known universe. Here it is, and you've all got one of these yourself. And here's the brain, and we've flipped it on its back, and here are the eyes. And this is where the eyes, via the optic nerve, enter the brain. And if you look just above where those optic nerves go into the brain, you find this structure, the suprachiasmatic nuclei. Paired, here's the space in the brain, the ventricle in the brain, and here we see the paired suprachiasmatic nuclei, the SCN. The yellow blobs here represent individual nerve cells within the SCN. And what's truly remarkable, and this is a fairly recent discovery, I mean, I would say 15 years old, that each of those individual cells has their own clock ticking away. You can take these out, stick them in a dish, and you'll see 24-hour oscillations of electrical activity. And what happens is that the 50,000 SCN neurons all work together to produce what's called the master body clock. They all coordinate to generate this master body clock. But if an individual cell can generate a 24-hour oscillation, then we know that the mechanism is not cell-cell interactions that drive this 24-hour oscillation, but it must be a subcellular molecular process. And I just want to touch on the mechanisms that actually generate a 24-hour oscillation within a single cell. Now, what we've got here is a cartoon of a cell. This is the nucleus, and this is a gene. There's two sorts of gene, the cry genes and the purr genes, and they have a bit in front of the coding region called the promoter. And what happens is that proteins bind to this promoter and then trigger the production of message and then proteins. Cry and purr proteins. The cry and purr proteins then form a complex, and in this form can enter the nucleus, and they then turn off the drive by clock and beamer. So the messages stop being produced, the proteins stop being produced, The proteins are then degraded, and once more, clock and BMAL can drive production. And so what you have in an individual cell is a rhythm of purr and cry, production and degradation, and that feeds back on the ability of these genes to produce a rhythmic oscillation. And that's it. That's a fundamental feedback loop. Now, what's really exciting is that changes in these clock genes are being linked to being a particular morning and evening sleep type. And we'll touch a little bit on morning and evening sleep types in a moment. In fact, now. So here we see a cartoon of sleep on each day. So this is when this individual was sleeping every day. And this is aligned to 11 o'clock in the evening. And you see the weekends, they're going to bed a little bit later. And this is probably being driven out of bed in the morning by the alarm clock during the week. That's normal sleep. There are individuals who show massively delayed sleep. They're going to bed very late and getting up very late, if they can. Most of us, of course, can't. The alarm clock is driving us out of bed in the morning, and so we only oversleep at the weekends. Or these individuals showing advanced sleep. So they're getting going to bed very early and getting up very early. There's an extraordinary condition called familial advanced sleep phase syndrome. And in this family, it's been shown that these individuals, no matter what they've been doing during the day, are forced, because of their internal clock, of going to bed at 7:30 in the evening and then waking up at around 4:30 in the morning. Their whole clock has been advanced through time, and it's the result of a tiny one change in the protein, in the PER protein. Absolutely remarkable. And it's one of the best examples we have of a tiny change in a gene being translated all the way through to a complex impact upon behaviour. One of the great successes, in fact, of the Human Genome Project. Okay. Are you a morning person or an evening person? We were going to try and test everybody in the audience today, but for reasons I won't bore you with, we can't. So what I'd encourage you to do is go to Google, type in Munich Sleep Questionnaire. This long website will come up, and you'll see this banner. And this is some lovely work developed by my friend and colleague, Till Renneberg. So if you want to find out whether you're a morning person or an evening person, then go online and fill in this questionnaire. Till and I did a session at the Cheltenham Science Festival last year. And we were a bit naughty, because Till, based in Munich, has got 60,000 Germans who've plugged into this website. And at that time, there were 2,000 Brits. And what we wanted was to actually get a few more Brits. So we said, right, we're going to compare the sleep habits of the Brits and the Germans. And it all got quite competitive and wonderful. And there were some really quite interesting differences. As you might predict, morningness and eveningness curves between the Brits and the Germans were identical. But things like social jet lag, which is the time your body clock would like to get you out of bed, but rather the time that your alarm clock is forcing you out of bed. The Germans have to get up earlier for work, on average. And so they have more social jet lag. And so I was contacted by the science correspondent of The Sun, and they were saying, so what are the consequences of this? And I said, well, and we'll see later on, there's all these health issues, and I listed all this, and I said, and indeed, even one's sense of humour can be affected by this. And you could almost hear his jaw drop with pleasure, thinking, I've got the banner headline I now need. But actually, it turned out to be a very interesting study. So we need more Brits, go online, let's really compare the Brits and the Germans and their sleep habits. Okay, so, alluding to your question, actually your question earlier, we've got this master clock. We've got this eye that sets the clock to local time. And then what I sort of implied was that this master clock, the SCN, forces rhythmicity, these 24-hour oscillations on the rest of the body. And it's not like that. We now know that essentially every cell in the body has the ability to generate a little molecular oscillation. So just like the SCN cells we talked about, individual cells, whether they be the lung, the gut, the muscles, could all take them out, stick them in a dish, and they'll show 24-hour oscillations for a few cycles. So our understanding of circadian clock organisation has really changed. And rather being a driver, you can think of the SCN as being a bit like the conductor of an orchestra, producing a rhythmic temporal signal from which the rest of the body, the component parts of the orchestra, take their reference cue and align their biology, their rhythmic biology, accordingly. Okay, that's been a really, really exciting discovery. Largely pioneered by Uli Schibler in Switzerland, who did some remarkable work in that area. But now what I want to sort of think about in a little bit more detail is the eye. Oh no, in fact I'm going to talk about sleep, I'll talk about the eye a bit more in a moment. We've talked about the clock, but there's a lot more to sleep generation than the clock. Here's the sleep-wake cycle, what you'll indulge in hopefully tonight over 8 hours or so. And we'll look at what's in that box at the moment. But let's now just think about the things that regulate that box in the brain. First of all, there's the clock, which we've talked about. This is saying, it's feeding onto a whole bunch of bits of the brain saying, now's a good time to be awake, now's a good time to be asleep. There's another important driver called the homeostat, which is the intuitive part about sleep. The longer you've been awake, the greater the need for sleep, the greater the build-up of sleep pressure. And certain chemicals have been identified in the brain which seem to build up as a result of being awake, and that they will also feed in to your tendency to be awake or be asleep. Now, of course, whether you've been awake or asleep will feed back upon the sleep pressure. There's a third really important factor in our own species, and I've already touched upon this, the alarm clock, social timing, which is forcing a sleep-wake pattern on very many of us because of either school or work or whatever. And of course, the sleep-wake will then feed back upon the social timing. For example, that oversleep at the weekends. The sleep-wake cycle then has a big impact, as we'll see later on in this presentation, on mood, one's cognitive abilities, and indeed mental health. And as we all know, probably intuitively, all of these feed very much back upon the sleep-wake cycle. So already you're getting a sense that whatever's in that box, and we'll unpack it in a moment, is being regulated by lots and lots of different sorts of factors. Now let's look at what's in that box. Oh yes, I'm sorry. And all of this is in turn being regulated by the light-dark cycle. Not only the clock, but of course one's level of alertness. Increase the amount of light and you feel more alert. Dim the lights and you feel more asleep. And that's impacting upon many of the structures within that box there. So here's a cartoon of the brain. And these different coloured blobs distributed throughout much of the basic, much of the brain are all involved in sleep regulation. The details aren't important. I just want to give you a sense of the diversity of structures. There's the basal forebrain. There's all of these different structures within the hypothalamus. Here's the SCN, the master clock. But the lateral hypothalamus producing orexin. Orexin, or hypocretin, is really important. Defects in that lead to narcolepsy, for example. You've got the midbrain, being really important in certain aspects of sleep, and then all of these four, five structures within the hindbrain, and all of these interact to generate normal sleep-wake arousal, sleep-wake patterns. And the point I'm trying to make is all this complexity makes sleep and wake very, very vulnerable to disruption. And that's going to be a theme I want to take up fairly shortly. What I want to touch on now is this whole eye, light, and time. But before I move on, any questions about the sort of neuroscience, any of the nuts and bolts about sleep and circadian rhythms? Yes?
What about the blind people, the SNC?
Yes, the blind people. I'm going to talk. In fact, you'll wish you hadn't asked that question. Because I will talk endlessly about blind people in a moment. It's a great question, and it's what I've spent a lot of time working on. Any other questions about mechanisms? Yes, at the back. Very, very good question. And we have a rather sobering case where we've studied that here in Oxford. In fact, a very good friend in college, her husband, had a tumour in his anterior hypothalamus. And he realised that this was going to invade. There's nothing could be done about it. And so he wanted to work with us. And so we looked at his rest activity profile as the tumour moved through the brain. And you saw the complete breakdown of these 24-hour patterns of oscillation. Actually, a lot of our understanding of this SCN has been from animal studies. It's one of the very few where we have empirical evidence from humans. Extremely brave man who did this, and it's turned out to be a remarkable study. So, again, great question. Okay, so let's now move on and think about the eye. And I said, eye sets the clock, in turn, coordinates this incredible sort of billions and billions of cells within the body all being appropriately, rhythmically regulated. But if you think about it, what we're asking the eye to do is two really very different tasks. Now, the familiar function of the eye, of course, is image detection. It's what you're doing now, looking and making a sort of an image of me. That's what we understand about the eye. But for the regulation of the clock, you don't want the transient detection of light and dark, the construct of an image. What you need is brightness detection. You need a measure of the overall amount of light within the environment over relatively long periods of time, so you can reliably judge both dawn and dusk. And one of the huge problems I had when I first got into this field is that I couldn't understand how a sensory system that would detect light and then turn off almost as soon as it's seen that light could also be used to get reliable measurements of brightness within the environment. It just didn't make sense. And this is a picture of the eye. Many of you will be familiar with these sorts of studies, this sort of image. And here are the rods and cones. These are the classical photoreceptors which collect light to build an image of the world. This is the inner retina. And these do the first stages of processing of the visual image before they pass on their information to the ganglion cells, whose processes form the optic nerves and go off into the brain. That's what we know about the eye. And about in the early 90s, I started studying mice. In fact, we had three different types of mutant mice which carried retinal diseases. They had naturally occurring retinal diseases in which the rods and cones had been largely but not completely lost. And with this huge insult to the visual cells, they had no ability to detect an image. And we then decided to look at these animals. And we put them in a running wheel. I'm sorry, three blind mice, yes. couldn't resist that. And so our question was very straightforward. If they have retained the ability to regulate their clock to the light-dark cycle, despite visual loss, they'll have a pattern like this. So here we see days down here. This is when they're active, when this is when they're asleep. And of course, this is the light-dark cycle. Is that right? Yes, that's right. They're asleep during the day. Good. And so if, despite visual loss, they showed that pattern, they'd still have a brightness detector system within the eye. If, along with visual loss, they had lost the ability to regulate the clock, then their clock would keep on ticking, but it would drift through time. And what we found, to our, I suppose, astonishment, was that these mice had a perfectly good rest activity profile. When you expose them to a light-dark cycle, despite the fact they had no vision, they could still regulate their clock perfectly normally. So we'd shown in these early experiments that visually blind mice were not clock blind. There's something weird and interesting going on here. And in fact, when we had these early data, we thought, well, maybe there's another receptor of the eye. Perhaps there's something else other than the rods and cones, and I won't bore you with all the history why we thought that might be likely. And when we proposed this, the response from the vision community, well, it's summarised in the next slide. It was ferocious. I did this early work in America, and so hence we've got American expressions. because I mean, I kid you not. I mean, I suppose I was young. I was 20 years younger. So you had the temerity to take on the vision world and say, well, maybe there's something else in the eye. The response was pretty ferocious. In fact, one person in a seminar, not quite like this, but it was in a hall. A modern hall, and I presented this idea, and this person stood up, said bullshit, and just walked out. Okay, the problem was we hadn't done the perfect experiment. The first set of criticisms were along the following lines. We've been studying the eye for over 150 years. Are you seriously telling us, Foster, that we've missed an entire class of photoreceptor? That was what was thrown at us a lot of the time. The more serious criticism was, well, you know, the circadian system can probably maintain normal photosensitivity with just a few rods and cones. Remember, in those mutant animals, we hadn't eliminated everything. There are a few, they were visually blind, but there are still a few visual cells left. And so what we had to do, of course, was geoengineer a mouse. And what we did was take a naturally occurring mutant and cross it with a transgenic animal, whereby all of the rods and cones were entirely and completely lost from the eye of this animal. And to our intense pleasure, they showed an absolutely normal rest activity profile. We were right and they were wrong, and I have an enormous amount of pleasure to say that. Because it's over 10 years. I mean, you know, people weren't funding our grants, people were publishing our papers. Not because the data weren't good, it's just conceptually they couldn't believe that this was going on. What about humans? That's all very well in a mouse, but do humans also show the same phenomenon? And we have studied relatively small numbers of individuals. Individuals, because of, again, the result of even more severe retinal degenerative diseases than those mice, where all of the rods and cones have been lost, the back of the eye looks in this appalling state, and they show normal 24-hour vision. So what we have is from both different strains of mice and genetically engineered mice and humans with natural lesions, there's got to be another photoreceptor in the eye. It's got to be different from the rods and cones, and now we know that about 1 in 100 of the ganglion cells, those cells that form the optic nerve, are directly light sensitive, and they are responsible for detecting the light and firing that information off to the suprachiasmatic nucleus and allowing us to lock internal time onto the light-dark cycle. That's what they look like. They're extraordinary cells. There's the cell body, and they have these great dendritic fibers, which are sensitive. And so what this lot do is form this sort of photosensitive net that encompasses the entire arc of the eye. It doesn't really matter where the light is coming from. These things will pick it up and then will fire that brightness information into the brain. And they have very interesting cellular properties. These can count photons. They can count light over hugely long periods of time. You can give the same amount of light squeezed into 5 minutes or expanded over 45 minutes, and that's read as the same signal. It's completely different from vision, and that's why this is how these brightness detector cells work. So, we have a group of photosensitive ganglion cells, and that's the wavelength to which they're most sensitive. So, looking at that now, you can have the intense satisfaction of knowing you're really stimulating your photosensitive ganglion cells. And of course, it's the blue of the sky. And so, it's a just-so story, and I wouldn't want to sort of get all spooky about it, but if you were God, designing a system, then this is exactly the wavelength, of course, to which you make them maximally sensitive, because this is the dominant wavelength in the sky for detecting brightness. Now, this is having really important implications for eye hospitals and clinical ophthalmology. And my department, the Nuffield Laboratory of Ophthalmology, is working very closely with members of the eye hospital, notably Susan Downs, to address these sorts of questions. The first point being, visual blindness need not result in loss of all of light detection by the eye. You can be visually blind, but not clock blind. Now, critically, sleep and 24-hour rhythms are essentially ignored entirely in clinical departments of ophthalmology around the world. So we've been asking the question of the patients that come through the doors, what's the impact of ocular disease on human sleep-wake biology? And the data that are emerging are really interesting. And I won't show you the data, I'll just summarise what we're finding. So, as we say, visual blindness need not mean complete blindness. There are many horrible conditions, genetic defects, where individuals have lost their rods and cones. And you have diabetic retinopathy, Leber's congenital amaurosis, and choroideremia. Now, these individuals will still have functional photosensitive ganglion cells, even though they've lost most of their visual cells. And under these circumstances, the ophthalmologist needs to say, okay, you are visually blind, but you still need to seek out sufficient light with your eyes to make sure your internal clock is regulated with the external world. And that's advice that is almost entirely lacking in most departments of ophthalmology in the entire world. It's even worse, because there has been a tendency to say, well, you know, you're blind. It's difficult to look after your eyes. They're a source of infection. They're no use to you. So why don't we just pop them out and put one of these in? Because it's so much easier to look after. And then, of course, completely unwittingly, you will then potentially be plunging an individual, they're already blind, but then they will essentially suffer unremitting jet lag for the rest of their lives. So this is a really serious issue, and it's now being addressed up the road in the eye hospital. In the same way, there are diseases which don't affect the rods and cones, but they affect this bit of the eye. So the rods and cones can no longer talk to the brain, and you've also lost the photosensitive ganglion cells. So there are diseases where you're both visually blind and clock blind. But under those circumstances, and that's, for example, severe glaucoma, these individuals now can benefit from treatments that help consolidate sleep. We talked about melatonin right at the beginning. Melatonin given to these individuals at 10, 11 o'clock at night can help consolidate the sleep-wake profile. So this is turning out to be a very important area, basic science that has informed clinical practice. So the clinical diagnosis of complete blindness must now assess the state of both the visual cells, the rods and cones, and these photosensitive ganglion cells. Eye loss, it's been appreciated, can plunge an individual in a world that lacks both vision and a proper sense of time. It's not just visual blindness, it's also a complete loss of any sense of time. And finally, clinical advice in ophthalmology must incorporate the impact of eye diseases on sleep-wake timing. We must get the appropriate evidence-based clinical advice to the patients. And if you think about the numbers here worldwide, 39 million people worldwide are completely blind. 285 million have major visual impairment. And a further 246 million have low vision. The extent to which knowledge about this other photoreceptor system within the eye could improve the quality of life of these individuals, I think, is a really important issue. And it's, again, beginning, finally, I think, to have some impact. Okay, any quick questions before we move on? Yes?
It may be a really silly question.
I doubt it.
So we have two eyes. As far as I know, that's how we perceive that.
Yes.
The way we make images.
Yeah.
Because we then, let's say, I just have one eye that has a problem.
Yes.
Does this affect...
It's a really interesting question. And we, in humans, we don't know the specific answer to that. In mice, for example, if one eye has been lost, it seems that the other eye compensates. And in fact, you don't lose too much sensitivity. You know, what you predict is you'd halve the sensitivity, but you don't seem to. So it may be those photosensitive ganglion cells are upregulated in some manner. It's a very interesting question. Don't know about humans. Yes. Ah, what a great question. Yes, they do. I'm sorry, this is such a great question. So that lady, who I showed you, who had lost her rods and cones, we asked her also, she did all these fantastic experiments for us, and said, well, do you have any conscious light detection? And she said, no, of course I don't. I'm blind. I've been blind for 50 years. And we said, okay, indulge us. If we just turn the lights on and off, can you tell us if the lights are on and off? She said, there's no point. I've got no light detection. We just said, just indulge us. Just pretend that you could. And you turn the lights on and off at different times, and she got it, 20 out of 20. She knew without recognising it when the lights are on and when the lights are off. So part of one's subconscious awareness of light at whatever level in the brain is also being mediated by these receptors. So, yeah, they're doing a lot more than just regulating the clock. In fact, part of our pupil constriction is being regulated by these receptors as well.
Did you try to do it with closed eyes?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't heat, because in fact, you see, so how do we know that it was not residual rods and cones mediating this response? How do we know it was those new receptors? And of course, we changed the wavelength of light, the colour of light. And it was only where at 480, in that blue part of the spectrum, where these cells peak, and in fact, the visual system does not peak. And that's when she was maximally sensitive. So that's how we knew it was due to those cells. Yeah, it's a really good question. Okay, the other time, crikey, I better move on. Working against the internal day. I alluded to the fact that all of this regulation of the sleep wake cycle, both within that box and its regulation, is horrendously complicated. And all this complexity makes sleep wake behaviour extremely vulnerable to disruption. We talked about shift work and the fact that despite working on the night shift for 20 years, they're still aligned to the local light-dark cycle, and therefore the body clock doesn't adapt to the demands of working at night. And many shift workers, as a result of the urine alarm clock and other functions, just get appalling sleep. But increasingly within our 24/7 society, it's not just shift workers. At all levels, at all age groups, many are getting 5 hours of sleep every night. I've just been working on a Channel 4 programme about sleep in teenagers. And I have to say that we got them to fill out sleep questionnaires, and I thought it would be bad, but I had no idea how bad it was. Many of these kids are getting 5 hours or less of sleep every night. And Mary Caskaden in the United States has shown at that age group, at 13, you need 9 hours for full brain performance. So they're getting half the amount of sleep they need. You've got fantastic teachers. I met this incredible headmistress and head of maths, head of English, all coming in, giving extra lessons to try and get these kids through their GCSEs, and the kids are falling asleep in class. So you've got all this infrastructure, which is essentially you can't exploit because the brain is half dead because these kids aren't getting enough sleep. And we can talk about why they're not getting enough sleep later. The consequences of disrupted sleep are now well documented. And I'm not going to go through this list, as you'll probably be absolutely delighted, but I will allude to some of the data. Drowsiness, microsleeps, unintended sleep. This is a classic study from night shift workers in a nuclear power plant. 60% of the workers admitted to falling asleep once a week, 4 to 5, 25% 4 to 5 times a week, 15% over 10 times a week. 33% of the workers admitted that falling asleep had caused a significant error or near miss once a year. This is in Sweden, incidentally. The most chilling and actually the most important piece of data is this one. All five controllers in this nuclear power plant had fallen asleep and they'd gone into stage 2, stage 3 sleep in the middle of the night shift. And then they fell asleep and then they sort of woke themselves up. And then the experimenters went in and said, "Were you aware you've just fallen asleep?" And they said, "Of course I haven't, I'm perfectly fine." And that's the really dangerous thing, because you're impaired and you don't know how impaired you are. You don't appreciate it. Metabolic problems and weight gain. Some beautiful data coming out of Ed Van Kouter's group in the United States. What Ed did was highlight this incredibly important metabolic axis, whereby sleep loss gives rise to the release of the hormone ghrelin, which predisposes you to hunger and predisposes you to weight gain. What she did was take healthy young males in their early 20s. One group were allowed to sleep only 4 hours of sleep a night, another group up to 10 should they want it. After 7 days, she measured the ghrelin level, and it was up by 28%. Carbohydrate consumption in those healthy young males had gone up to 35 to 40%. And when she gave an infusion of glucose, the ability to clear that glucose from the circulation was bordering on the diabetic. That's after only 7 days. So no wonder there's a predisposition to weight gain in night shift and in individuals who are sleep deprived. And there's a corresponding, incidentally, lowering of the satiation hormone, leptin. That was down by 17% and that was up by 28%. Really important metabolic effects of screwing up the sleep axis. And it's new data like this that is beginning to understand these very large epidemiological studies showing that if you sleep for 4 hours or less, there's a 73% likelihood of being obese, clinically obese, 5 hours, 50%, 6 hours, 23%. Now, you can get a bit, you can run away with these data. And many people have said, this is the basis of childhood obesity. Children are sleeping much less, therefore they're getting obese. You have to be a bit careful, because, okay, you're sleeping 4 hours, you're awake for 20 hours, so you're going to be eating a lot more. But the point about these data is that you're metabolically predisposed to eat more. And that's really, I think, a very interesting set of data that's emerging. Decreased cognitive performance, reduced ability to remember and concentrate. Here is a fMRI, looking at brain activity of a fully breasted brain performing mathematical tasks. The same individual after sleep deprivation. That's the level of activity. It's just a brilliant illustration of how the brain is impaired as a result of sleep deprivation. And the really dangerous thing is that tired brains like this then indulge in stimulant and sedative use. So the really tired brain, the second thing it will ask you to do when you get out of bed is probably have a cup of coffee. And if it's a really bad brain, it'll be have a nicotine. Caffeine is an extremely effective way of staying awake. You know, we talked about that sleep pressure, that build-up of sleep pressure. In fact, caffeine interferes with those chemicals that drive that sleep pressure. Nicotine is also an extremely effective stimulant. Problem is, caffeine can stay, its half-life can stay in the body at high levels between 5 and 9 hours. So if you're taking caffeine after lunch, middle of the afternoon, and remember, the waking day is fueled by caffeine in many people, then it's going to delay the point at which you can get to sleep. You think, my God, I've got to get up in 6 hours, 7 hours. What the hell am I going to do? I've got to get some sleep. So then you take alcohol or you take some sort of sedative. And those will knock you into sleep. They will sedate you, but they don't provide a biological mimic for sleep. So what happens is many of the benefits of sleep are sedated as a result of these agents. So you need more caffeine and nicotine. You take more during the day, you need more sedative. And this stimulant sedative feedback loop, I can see many people nodding in the audience saying, yes, that describes my life, or no. And it does. I mean, it really is terrifying. And of course, here's a fact that you can amuse your friends with. After oil, coffee beans are the highest traded commodity on the open market. I mean, I'd love to have a plot of, I must do it one day, of looking at the openings of the consumption of coffee by Costa and Starbucks versus reduced sleep as a result of our 24/7 society. It's not just adults, it's children too. And I, again, going back to this Channel 4 programme that's going to be out in a few months, I chatted to some of these 13-year-olds and I said, do you have any problems getting to sleep? And this young girl said to me, oh, no, no, because I take sleeping tablets. This is a 13-year-old child. And then I said, well, do you take things like Red Bull and caffeinated drinks? Oh, yeah, that's great. I really find that really helps me a lot. So we have 13-year-olds who are already locked in to the stimulant sedation feedback loop. And I think, actually, it's bordering on a public health crisis. Final bit of terror, reduced immunity, disease and viral infection. A big impact upon sleep loss. So this is a good example where natural killer cells, this is an element of the immune system, and we have a very distinguished immunologist, I noted, in the audience. One night without sleep, and the activity of these cells is reduced by as much as 28%. So if you're sleep deprived and tired, your immune system will be suppressed, which may start to explain why sleep deprivation may be associated with higher rates of cancer in night shift workers. So for example, night shift nurses have higher rates of colorectal cancer and breast cancer. And some of you may remember that Danish study where, in fact, Danish night shift nurses were compensated because they had higher rates of cancer and it was linked back to their very disrupted sleep-wake cycle. Anybody care to speculate why you might be immune-suppressed if you don't get much sleep? Any thoughts? I know there's some students in the audience, maybe some physiologists. Who thought of this? I don't see a flurry of hands. Okay, well, one of the things is how do you override the effects of wanting to fall asleep? You activate the stress axis. Now, one thing we know about, of course, elevated stress hormones, things like cortisol, is they're immunosuppressives. So we think the link may well be associated elevated stress, reduced immunity. Okay, so we've talked about working against the clock. And any quick questions before we go to mental illness and yes?
The effect of computer screen light at night?
Very good question. it's probably not enough to shift the body clock. Certainly, if you have a computer screen at night and you're seeing a normal light-dark cycle the next day, the clock will automatically defer to the brighter light signal as being the day-night signal. The danger with those computer screens is that they increase levels of alertness. and essentially that will delay onset of sleep at night. So there's been a lot of discussion about this in the press. I don't think we have good evidence to say they'll shift the clock. They have an effect upon melatonin, for example, but that's different. Where I think that the issue is they're increasing levels of alertness, and therefore, and it's not just the light, of course, it's what you're doing. I mean, many of these kids are gaming. And so that, you know, the brain is, you know, wired. They're still using caffeinated drinks, and they've got light. I mean, this, it's hopeless. I mean, that's why they're asleep. Okay, let's now... I won't spend long on this last topic. I just want to draw your attention to some really interesting emerging areas of neuroscience. Disrupted sleep and mental illness has a... This association has an incredibly long history. This was talked about by Emil Kraepelin, who is sort of thought to be the father of psychiatry back in the 1880s. Noted, well noted. And of course there are lots of well-known examples of mental illness and disturbed sleep. Vincent van Gogh, I often think that the night is more alive and more richly coloured than the day. He was awake a lot of the time at night. And I think a very tragic quote from van Gogh, I put my heart and my soul into my work and have lost my mind in the process. So there are lots of well-documented examples. But sleep-wake disruption in schizophrenia and other mental illnesses has often been simply dismissed as a result of the antipsychotic medication they're on. You're on these drugs, so no wonder your sleep gets screwed up. Or abnormal sleep is often associated with a basis of a lack of work. And this is what got Katerina and I into this whole area. We were talking to a psychiatrist in a lift, or at least I was. Katerina, were you there? I always think you were, but you were there. You were there too. And this chap said, "Oh yeah, well my patients can't hold down a job. So no wonder they get up late. Miss my clinic and don't have friends." It was simply dismissed as the social isolation of these individuals, and that made absolutely no sense to us as clock biologists. The old view, if it was ever thought about at all, is that psychiatric illness activates the stress axis, it's social isolation, it's medication, and that gives rise to the sleep and circadian rhythm disruption. That's it. And incidentally, even though this is well documented in almost all psychiatric illnesses, it is almost never treated. So Katerina and I decided to look at this. So how bad is sleep-wake disruption in schizophrenia? Let's get the evidence. And I won't bore you with all the details, but there are devices, little wristwatch devices that you can wear, which measure activity. And this looks at an individual who's got a job. And here's midnight, and here's 8 o'clock in the morning. And we've double-plotted the data. So here's day one, day two. And we've done it like this so you can see the hours between midnight and 8 o'clock in the morning. And you see there's very little activity. This is a very stable sleep-wake profile. And this is the hormone melatonin, which is very tightly controlled by the clock and is peaking at around about 4 o'clock in the morning. Here's an employed individual. In fact, I think it's you, isn't it, Katerina?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's getting up, I think, at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a little bit late, but there you go. here's an unemployed individual. Actually, and this is Katerina's idea, she thought, well, how do we deal with the social isolation issue? Well, let's deal with individuals who have no structured date, who don't have a job. And to our surprise, I think, is that actually the sleep-wake profile is a bit delayed in the unemployed, but actually overall is not statistically different from the employed. These are the sorts of patterns you get from schizophrenia. So this is an individual between midnight and 8 o'clock in the morning. The pattern is drifting. This is their activity. It's drifting into the night. Look at where the hormone profiles are drifting way out. They're almost 12 hours in the wrong position here, and all this activity going on, and it's basically degenerated into a non-24-hour pattern. This is a patient or an individual we've studied since 2001 and is still in contact, and she had a very delayed pattern, and then she'd break away. She'd just about lock on again, and then she'd break away, and had an incredibly disruptive sleep-wake pattern. 2004, her pattern, she was getting up and going to bed later and later and later every night. This is a really severe sleep-wake disruption. I mean, this is not just mild, this is extraordinarily bad. Not even mutant mice show a pattern like that. This is a sort of spectrum of disturbance you see from the disrupted but recognisably 24-hour through to the drifting patterns to individuals who show no 24-hour patterns whatsoever. This is really radically appalling. And this led us to think about a different way of thinking about psychiatric illness and sleep and circadian rhythm disruption. And that our view is that there's an overlap. There are common overlapping mechanisms in the brain that predispose you to mental illness and sleep and circadian rhythm disruption. Of course, the sleep and circadian rhythm disruption will lead to cognitive health problems, developmental issues, and stress axis. And what's so very striking is that all of these lists of consequences of disrupted sleep that we talked about before are endemic in mental illness. So, for example, the decreased motor performance, the decreased cognitive performance, the reduced ability to concentrate and remember, is that the product of psychiatric illness, or is it the product of the sleep disruption that these individuals are facing? Of course, the psychiatric illness will also feed back upon the sleep and circadian rhythm disruption. These are modulators, but the origins of the disruption are because of common overlapping mechanisms. Okay, that's the hypothesis. And this is new. How have we been able to test this? Okay, what about common overlapping mechanisms? And our argument here has been that gene abnormalities linked to psychiatric illness will also play a role in sleep disruption. And furthermore, sleep disruption probably precedes psychiatric illness under certain circumstances, if there is a genuine overlap here. Not that the psychiatric illness produces that. In fact, you might predict that you'd see sleep and circadian rhythm disruption before any signs of psychiatric illness. And then, of course, this, sleep and circadian rhythm disruption, further exacerbating the psychiatric illness. So what evidence do we have for these potential overlaps here? Okay, what's the sleep pattern of a mouse when candidate schizophrenia genes are ablated or mutated? We published this at the end of last year. This is a great collaboration between my group and Kay Davis's group, just down the road in the Department of Physiology, Anatomy and Genetics. And again, I won't bore you with the details, but we put mice, normal mice, into a running wheel. This is the pattern that you get, a beautiful, crisp response to the light-dark cycle. When you mutate a gene that's been linked to schizophrenia in these mice, the sleep-wake pattern is remarkably similar to the sorts of patterns you're seeing in schizophrenia. These mice are running during the light phase, not the dark phase. They're fragmented, and in fact, some of them show very little 24-hour patterns whatsoever. So if we're looking for evidence for an overlap between those genes that are linked to schizophrenia and those genes that give rise to normal sleep-wake disruption, we've already got evidence for it. And in fact, we've got unpublished data from another mouse model which is suggesting the same thing, another gene. What about sleep disruption probably preceding psychiatric illness? This is, again, a project with Katerina, and this is Guy Goodwin, who is in psychiatry. And this is comparing those young individuals who are at low risk of developing bipolar disorder and those who are at high risk of developing bipolar. They are not showing any clinical signs of this bipolar, but they're at high risk. And what's interesting, here's the low-risk individual, a nice, crisp sleep-wake pattern. In those at high risk, you're beginning to see a breakdown in the normal rest activity cycle. So again, our hypothesis that sleep disruption probably precedes, in many circumstances, that psychiatric illness is already being supported. What about the final? Sleep and circadian correction might actually improve the psychiatric condition. And these are work by Dan Freeman. Dan Freeman has used ways, he's taken patients with schizophrenia who have appalling sleep wake, and he's used ways to try and stabilize their sleep. This is their insomnia score, the higher here, the worse the insomnia, before treatment, and then after treatment, and then with a follow-up. So, okay, what about their psychiatric illness, their delusions? This is the level of delusion if you don't treat the abnormal sleep, but if you treat the abnormal sleep, you halve the level of delusions. You don't get rid of them, you wouldn't predict that, but you do have a positive impact upon the psychiatric condition. So I think what's really exciting is that basic science again, an interest in how circadian rhythms are generated and regulated has given rise to perhaps a new understanding of some aspects of psychiatric illness and potentially some new ways of intervening therapeutically. So let's try and summarise that. Why am I interested in this? Well, I want to get a better understanding of the neural and the genetic mechanisms that are common to sleep, sleep-wake timing and neuropsychiatric illness, the basic neuroscience. Use sleep and circadian disruption as a biomarker in early diagnosis in neuropsychiatric conditions. We don't know. One of the experiments we're going to try is that if we can try and stabilise sleep-wake early on in these individuals who are at high risk of developing psychiatric illness, will we delay onset? Will we knock the brain into a different developmental trajectory and perhaps mitigate some of the problems? Simply don't know, but it's a new way forward. And finally, use agents that regulate sleep and sleep timing for the reduction of symptoms and for improved quality of life in neuropsychiatric illness. Okay, I fear I've gone on for 15 minutes longer than I should have, and I do apologise. What I wanted to do in the past hour and 15 minutes was give you some sort of sense of internal time, and that physiology is incredibly dynamic. It's always being tweaked and fine-tuned by an internal clock. One of the great success stories, I think, in neuroscience has been an understanding of these mechanisms within the brain that give rise to both the clock and the sleep-wake processes. And that in the process of trying to understand how the sleep-wake cycle is aligned to the light-dark cycle, we discovered a completely new light sensor within the eye. And it's really changed our understanding of the nature of blindness, and there's big implications in terms of clinical ophthalmology. We then talked about an increasingly 24/7 society, which is essentially disregarding the importance of sleep and not taking sleep disruption seriously. And there are major health consequences, from cognitive impairment to suppressed immune system and to metabolic abnormalities. And all sectors of society, and most worryingly our young, our teenagers, are being exposed to this I think, appalling physiological and behavioural insult. And then finally, emerging data whereby an understanding of the neuroscience of sleep and circadian rhythms led to a sort of a jump sideways to understand a completely different condition, which is mental illness. And this association between sleep and circadian rhythm disruption and mental illness might give us some additional handles on early diagnosis, but importantly, some new ways of thinking of treating these ferociously debilitating conditions. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.